regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace.
I have a dream that one day
a soldier of peace,
this nation will rise up,
a soldier of peace,
live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream,
though a soldier of peace.
I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. Every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it.
Nonviolence Radio, covering the beat of nonviolence worldwide, from the Meta Center for Nonviolence in Petaluma, California. Welcome to another episode of Nonviolence Radio. I'm Stephanie Van Hook. On June 20th, the Poor People's Campaign is marching on Washington with the message that everyone's got a right to live. Find out more at june2020.org, and now we'll play their list of demands.
Everybody
has a right
to live.
Health care.
Everybody.
Don't stop.
The Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, has come up with a series of demands. And I want you to say those demands after I say them.
I know that you are here for the same reasons we all are here, to put our elected officials on notice. We demand an immediate restoration of the Voting Rights Act. We demand an end to racist gerrymandering. We demand a reversal of state laws that prevent municipalities from raising minimum wage. We demand a just immigration system. We demand a timely citizenship process that guarantees everyone the right to vote.
We demand an end to military aggression and warmongering. We demand a stop to privatization of military budget and any increase in military spending. We demand a ban on assault rifles and a ban on the easy access of firearms. We demand an end to federal programs that send military equipment into local and state communities. We demand that the call to build a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border be ceased.
We demand a ban on fracking, mountaintop removal, coal mining, coal ash ponds, and offshore drilling. We demand a ban on all new pipelines, refineries, and coal, oil, and gas export terminals.
We demand an immediate implementation of federal and state living wage laws. We demand the right for all workers, to form and join unions. We demand equal pay for equal work. We demand a guaranteed annual income. We demand fully funded anti-poverty programs that protects the welfare of us all.
We demand decent housing.
We demand free tuition. We demand free tuition. We demand equity in education. We demand an end to the resegregation of schools.
We demand equitable funding
for historically black colleges and universities. We demand relief from crushing household, student, and consumer debt. We demand the repeal of the 2017 federal tax law. And we demand that the wealthy and corporations pay their fair share.
Pay their fair share.
We believe that we can win.
We believe
that we can win.
We believe
that we can win.
We believe
that everybody,
everybody,
has a right,
has a right,
to live,
to live,
to live.
I want you to know that when hands that once picked cotton join hands of Latinos, join hands of progressive whites, join faith hands and labor hands and Asian hands and Native American hands and poor hands and wealthy hands with a conscience and gay hands and straight hands and trans hands and Christian hands and Jewish hands and Muslim hands and Hindu hands and Buddhist hands. When we all get together, we are an instrument of redemption. When we join hands, we can revive and make sure that the promise of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and equal protection under the law is never taken away from anybody. So I got a question. Are the rejected ready to revive and declare that this land is your land? This land is my land. This land is our land. And together, from the State House to the White House, the rejected are going to demand that this nation never give up on being one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Reverend William Barber, one of the most prominent leaders of the Poor People's Campaign and who's been a guest before on Nonviolence Radio, spoke to the Poor People's Campaign rally in Portland, Maine in October of 2019. Let's tune into what he had to say then.
Whenever we come in these places, you know, we don't do silo movements. It's interlocking. You can't come anywhere in America and not honor the land, the original people who were on the land. To try to do that and move forward is just wrong, right? We have to honor the indigenous people. When we talk about our Latino brothers and sisters, some movement has to stop calling people undocumented and aliens when they're simply coming back to land that was theirs in the first place. Texas belonged to Mexico, and before it was Texas and New Mexico. We have to, truth is the only thing that can set us free. And this movement must be built on truth. We need massive turnout from Maine. Every church bring a bus, every city bring a bus, every county bring a bus, every club bring a bus. And we need to just spread it all over the country. If every city in the country would just bring one bus, just every city, right? Every county would just bring one bus, not two, just one. And we might have a massive gathering in our nation's capital, not as an end, not as an end. This is not about ending. This is about continuing. This is long term. This is pushing deep into the transformational consciousness of this nation. I want to raise tonight a text from Hebrews, an ancient text, Hebrews chapter 10, verse 39. When the people who were in this movement following this brown-skinned Palestinian Jew, who had the audacity to list the poor, the broken, the bruised, the battered, the captives, and everybody that were made to feel unaccepted as the key, as of his focus, as the vision for his movement. And that was at the beginning of his movement, and then just before he was assassinated by the state for being a revolutionary, he came back to that same group. He said, every nation, not every individual church, but every nation, every government would be judged by whether they cared for the poor, the hungry, the sick, the immigrant, and those on the margins. And he said every nation and every religion that refused to do those things about justice was a form of hypocrisy. And for that, they killed him. But nonviolently, he stood up and exposed the nation's ugliness. And when this text was written in Hebrews 10:39, some of the people that had followed this brown-skinned Palestinian Jew who had been born in the ghetto, a place called Nazareth, he had been crucified and raised, but he wasn't walking with them, and they were getting worn out. They were thinking about turning back because, see, by this time, and even in his day, there was this whole history, a lineage of these guys that loved to run the country and they loved to put their names on buildings. They were arrogant as all get out, you know. They believed the world turned around. It wasn't just one of them. It was a whole cadre of them, right? And they catered to the wealthy, and they destroyed the least of these. And they even put their faces on the money, right? And they called themselves Caesar. Caesar. And this particular, by this time, the Caesars were just going for it. I mean, they were just hurting people. And the people that were in the movement were thinking about just quitting. And we think it was the Apostle Paul, it could have been someone else, said, wait a minute, do you know who you are? And in Hebrews 10, turn this up, some in Hebrews 10:39, he says, look, we are not of those who shrink back unto destruction. But we are those who persevere unto the salvation. So one translation says, we are not those who quit, but we are those who keep right on getting up, rising up, no matter what. Because faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. In essence, the writer was saying, in the midst of great tribulation and trial and political violence, we must know who we are, because properly defining oneself and one's nature and one's calling is critical. It is a critical philosophical and theological discipline that has penetrating and practical implications, particularly when you're in crisis. When you are facing a season of challenge and confronting threats that seek to take your identity and seek to redefine you, who you are, seek to ignore you. When you are in a fight and we are facing what Paul Tillich called the very threat of non-being and non-existence, knowing who you are is critical in the face of enemies and adversaries that are trying to take from you who you are. Martin Luther King once did not diagnose some of America as having a neurotic sickness and a septic commitment to racism, poverty, militarism that was destroying America's soul and ripping it apart. And he said, the only way to address these matters, we have to rise with others and raise up a campaign with poor people and moral leaders, and those who have nothing to lose are the only ones that might have the moral and spiritual capacity to turn the nation's consciousness and character towards the way of love, truth, and justice and nonviolence. And my friends, just moving up some because I have such a sensitive ear and hear so here. We are in one of those moments now. The issue for us now is not can the Democratic Party survive, and not can the Republican Party survive, but can America be? It is a question that Langston Hughes asked in the 1930s, but it is more real today when he said, America, America, America has never been America to me, but I swear this oath that America will be. But the question is before us, will America be? And we're in the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival. We're here to demand more from America. America can be better. America can move closer to being a more perfect union. This is the third Reconstruction time. The first Reconstruction was the time immediately after slavery. Second Reconstruction was the Civil Rights Movement, 1954 to 68. We're in the midst of the birth pains of a third Reconstruction. And some folk know it, and they do not want it to happen because every Reconstruction of America has always faced pushback. The moratorium, we must do more, mobilizing, organizing, registering, and educating people for the movement who vote tour is about turning our demands into action. We began in El Paso by invitation. The deafs were there. The Latinos said, come back and start here and talk about all the issues, because we don't want to only talk about racism and white nationalism when some people are gruesomely shot, because that is a form of white nationalism. But often that form of white nationalism comes after rhetoric and policy of white nationalism has been sown into the wind. We sow to the wind and we reap the whirlwind. And our Latino brothers and sisters said, don't isolate us, because we understand that the same folk that are against Latino immigrants are against health care and against public education and against voting rights and against the LGBT community. We understand that. So we began in El Paso, we end in Tennessee in the Mississippi Delta, and then we go on to DC, more mobilizing the poor people and their allies, organizing moral fusion coalitions, or registering people for the movement that vote, educating our people about the issues that we must be concerned about. And the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, is not another organization. See, we don't need any more organizations. We got enough. We need organizations to put down their organizational egos and come together. That's what we need. And so Liz and I are not saying, let us take over all the organizations. We want folk to keep their organization. It's important that you do silo work. It's important that your pinky finger works. It's important that your thumb works. But if you want power, every now and then all of them have to come together. They didn't have an abolition organization. They had an abolition movement. They didn't have a women's suffrage organization. They had organizations, but all of them formed a movement. A movement. And we ought to be able to come together and do some significant things together to build power and shift the narrative. Because if we never shift the narrative and shift the political imagination, the moral imagination, then you're never going to have moral implementation. You're never going to have it. And so that's what the Poor People's Campaign is about, a national call for moral revival. All of us finding ways to come together across all of our lines and believing that we are not those who shrink back. We are not those who quit. There's a reason why all of you all are here tonight in this place. Some with gray hair, some with not so gray hair. I like to say to the ones with gray hair, you got to suit up one more time. I like to say those with less gray hair, it's time to pay your debt for all the stuff other people did for you that you might have what you have. And I like to say to the real young folk, you might as well learn how to fight early. We are not of those. This movement is about saving the soul of this nation. Soul of this nation is in trouble. In trouble. We are here because systemic poverty is, racism is real. And when we say racism, we are not talking about somebody calling you the N-word. We are not talking about somebody calling people names. We're talking about policy. like racist voter suppression, like mistreatment of people of color, immigrants, like mass incarceration, resegregation of public schools, and the continued oppression of native people, indigenous. That's racism. That's why sometimes we say in this campaign, Adam, even though the media likes to say it, the greatest racist right now in politics is not Trump. I knew y'all wasn't gonna say nothing. See, because Trump is loud and out there. And there's a book called Stamp from the Beginning, and it talks about how the words are distractions from the policy. They want us to get focused on the person with the most influence over white nationalist racist policy being placed into our system right now is Mitch McConnell. And you've not heard him say any ugly words. And please don't act like Trump is new. Reagan used the same language. Nixon used the same language. They just didn't have a 24-hour news cycle, and they were smart enough not to say it out in public. Or maybe Trump is shrewd and smart, or at least those around him. Because if we keep the focus on him, we miss all of the judges he's putting on the bench. Y'all see what, and all the other policies. Mitch McConnell, for instance, along with Boehner and Ryan, held up fixing the Voting Rights Act for over 2,000 days. Think about that. We have less voting rights today than we had August 6, 1965. And yet, Strom Thurmond held up fixing the Civil Rights Act of 57 for one day. And we call Strom Thurmond a racist. America's in trouble. And we have to know it, but then we have to have a movement of people that know it doesn't have to be that way. Touch your neighbor and say, the work is real. Just touch him. We do this down south. I'm just eating. Touch your neighbor and say, the work is real. Yeah, yeah. Did you know that long before Trump was ever even thought about running, 23 states in this country passed racist voter suppression laws since 2010? Targeting 54% of African-American voters. But did you know that the people who get elected by racist voter suppression laws, once they get elected, they pass policies that hurt mostly white people? Now, that's the irony. The very ones that suppress the vote, when they get elected, they pass laws that mostly hurt poor, low-income white people, because there are 66 million poor and low-income white people. There are 26 million poor and low-income black people. That's 61% of all black people. It's only 30% of all white people, but it's 40 million difference in raw numbers. So that is why you cannot see the fight against racist voter suppression as just black folks fight. Because racism is not just about being against black folk. Racism is against democracy itself. It's against democracy itself. That's why we see what we're seeing now, so many attacks on democracy. And this guy that acts like he wants to be a king. Why? Because now that certain people are no longer in the majority, they no longer want to push democracy. Now that there's a possibility for black, white, and brown people to come together and elect candidates of their choice, all of a sudden, somebody's cheating. All of a sudden, we need photo ID. All of a sudden, like here in Maine, we have to pass racist voter suppression laws against the native people and indigenous people. Did you know that there's, yes, you heard Liz say there are 140 million people who are poor and low income, and she gave you the numbers? I got you. You know how it is. But did you know that 600 people die every day from poverty? 600 people die every day from poverty and low wealth. 600 people every day. Now, watch this. If one person gets shot by a racist cop, we're in the street, and we should be. 7 people died from vaping, and it's a national crisis. 600 people die every month, every day from poverty. And you don't even hear poverty in our political debates. Did you know there's abundance of resources? Did you know that legislators, congresspeople make an average of $15 a minute? But we've locked people up who make $15 an hour. Did you know the largest number of people who are homeless are LGBTQ children, youth? 30 million people don't have health care, but here's the piece on that. Here's the piece on that. 30 million people don't have health care, but for every 1 million people, about 6,000 die. If we had a single-payer health system, it would save $310 billion. But even deeper than that, Reverend, there's a group of clergy, I hope some of y'all will join us. We've decided if anybody in our church dies from the lack of health care, we're going to ask the families to allow us to have an open casket funeral like Mamie Till did for her baby. Bring the media in, and we're not going to lie anymore and say God called them home. We're going to say God will welcome them home, but government killed them. Did you know 4 million families, you heard Liz talk about water, but 4 million families get up every morning, they can buy unleaded gas and can't buy unleaded water. Did you know not only do we lie about Latino immigrants and say they're illegal when they're simply coming back the land we stole, that Abraham Lincoln stood against and Henry David Thoreau stood against, his first act of civil disobedience was against the Spanish-American War or Mexican War, but did you know that if it wasn't for the Social Security payments that Latinos put into the Social Security system, that they will never have access to the system, your Social Security would implode? Did you know that Native Americans, indigenous people, are still seen as wards of the state? They still operate under war treaties. They can't even own their own homes. Did you know that we have 800 military bases around the world? 800. Did you know we could cut $350 billion from our military spending and we would still have a military budget bigger than China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea combined? Did you know people are making a killing off of killing? Did you know people are living in homeless camps? Like we visited one, and this lady was a lady there, and a white lady and a black woman. The white lady had a health crisis. She had been middle class, health crisis, now she's homeless. Black man worked every day, had to live in the homeless camp. They were down the path in the woods from a church that had on its billboard, gay people are going to hell. And 200 yards from that church were poor children, poor women living in the woods. And when we went down there, the one thing they said to us is, don't forget us. Don't let America forget us. And by the way, did you know there's this extreme religious nationalism? I hope nobody's preaching. It's really a form of heresy. It's a form of a theological malpractice, at best heresy. It goes like this. The way to please God is to hate gay people, be against women's right to choose, be for prayer in the school, be for tax cuts, and you know God loves guns, so be for guns and wave the flag. Even though in the Hebrew Bible and the Christian Bible, the old, what we call Old New Testament, there are more than 2,000 scriptures in the Bible that say how we treat the poor and women and children and the immigrant is what's most important to the divine spirit. And yet those that are influencing so much of the Congress, so much of state houses and the president are those who believe in this false religious narrative that comes from slaveholder religion and has had various metamorphoses down through history, even till now. I often tell folks, why are you so interested in somebody else's bedroom? Huh? And I tell them, I want to talk about sex, Bishop. I really do. You know the sex I want to talk about? I want to talk about the illicit relationship between the Supreme Court and big business that produced the bastard child of Citizens United. That's the sex I want to talk about. That's the sex I want to talk about. But But in Maine, it's not just national. 41% of all people in Maine are poor and low wealth. In Maine, you have to work 80 hours a week just to afford a basic two-room bedroom apartment. And it doesn't have to be this way. If we passed a $15 federal minimum wage, not 12 years from now, but immediately, 49 million workers' work wages would go up, and it would pump $328 billion a year back into the economy. If we repeal the Trump tax cut and establish fair taxes on the wealthy and corporation, it would generate $886 billion per year to rebuild our infrastructure and education and healthcare. If in 2018, if we just ended the military contract of one company, not two, just one, it could fully fund the 14 states expanding Medicaid or the Affordable Care Act who have refused to it. Just one. Just one. Somebody say, just one. So here's where we are and why we have to gather and why we have to build a movement. All over this country, state houses, governors, and legislators, some of the most radical are in the poorest states. And yes, the Supreme Court has gutted the Voting Rights Act. And yes, we have people in the United States Senate and House and other places who are pushing programs to hurt the poor and deny workers. And yes, the same people that do that support the wall, and the same people that support the wall want to block health care, the same people that want to block health care want to block living wages, and the same people that block living wages, they want to block any effort to deal with climate change. And most of those same people hide behind a false religious narrative that says nothing about racism and homophobia and poverty. And yes, they are spending more and more money on militarism, and yes, they have a lot of money. But in the face of this, we must know who we are. We must know who we are. Frederick Douglass, in the 1800s, faced a time like this. A guy had been forced onto the Supreme Court that had no business being there. His name was Justice Taney. And he became the Supreme Court justice that oversaw the Dred Scott decision. And the Dred Scott decision came out and said a black man has no rights that a white man ever has to honor. 2 months after that decision, Frederick Douglass was asked to speak. How you feel? What you gonna do? Don't you believe that the abolition movement is over now? I mean, the Supreme Court has ruled. Let me tell you what Douglass said. Douglass said, the slaveholders are earnest. They mean to cling to their slaves as long as they can to the bitter end. And yes, the Supreme Court of the United States has ruled, but there's another Supreme Court higher than the Supreme Court of man. He said, yes, Goliath was big, but have you read the rest of the story about David? He said, what I see in this moment, he said, I have cheer. I'm actually somewhat happy. He said, because I know that every attempt to blot out forever the hopes of the enslaved people may just be one necessary link in the chain of events preparatory to the downfall and complete overthrow of the whole slave system. He then said the whole history of the anti-slavery movement is studied with proof that all measures devised and executed with the view to allay and diminish the anti-slavery agitation have only served to increase, intensify, and embolden that agitation. There comes a time that when your adversary is hitting you hard, that's a sign of how strong you are. Don't you know they wouldn't be lying so much and spending so much money and blocking the vote so much if we were not powerful together? And so we have to come to a point that every attack on the poor will embolden our agitation. Every attack on sick folk will embolden our agitation. Every attack on immigrants will embolden our agitation.
You're at Nonviolence Radio, and you are listening to Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign. They're hosting a moral march on Washington, D.C. on June 20th, 2020. Find out more about the nonpartisan campaign and how to get involved at poorpeoplescampaign.org. Let's turn now to nonviolence in the news with Michael Negler.
Thank you, Stephanie. Yeah, well, there's just never been so much and potentially so hopeful and exciting stuff to report on. So let me just share a brief selection because, of course, a lot of this news is still developing as we speak. I guess one mention on the negative side is that a kind of Antifa hysteria is sweeping the country and small towns especially. And as Nicholas Kristof says, the panic is a measure of how deluded public discourse has become. But to look at the bright side, which is much better, of course, today is Juneteenth. As we know, it's a great day in the racial history of America, which now we need to make real. So on the minds of most of the thoughtful people with some background in nonviolence is, how will this great commotion that's going on, which has left behind an initial spasm of violence, possibly caused by provocateurs, how will that commotion become a movement? And I, for one, am confident that it can do that. I have a recent article of mine in LA Progressive called From Rage to Reform. And it starts with this sentence. George Floyd is becoming the Emmett Till of the 21st century. And I go on. The ongoing, passionate, widespread, and no longer violent demonstrations that have come in the wake of his brutal death have given us an opportunity like that of Till's horrible death was for the civil rights movement 70 years ago. His death, you may remember, led 5 years later to the lunch counter sit-ins and the freedom rides 1 year after that. So I sketch out what I think has to happen for the commotion to become a movement. George Lakey has added some very more cogent detail in Waging Nonviolence. And Wednesday, there was an article in the New York Times, an interview with five living veterans of the civil rights movement with their priceless experiences to offer, an article by Ellen Barry called Seven Lessons and Warnings from Those Who March with Dr. King. I heartily recommend it. As usual, there's a number of very helpful, very fact-filled blogs that are on the ICNC website, that International Center for Nonviolent Conflict. They will talk about the question of provocateurs and the question of radical flanks or diversity of tactics that seems to inevitably come up when passions are roused to this degree. And yet are never found to be very helpful, very provocative. That is, these not violent flanks, they seem justified, but as I've always argued, justification is not the question we ought to be asking. We ought to be asking about effectiveness. And there was an article back in January in the Washington Post that is now reprinted by ICNC called How the World is Proving Martin Luther King Right About Nonviolence. They say, since 2011, the world has been a deeply contentious place. Although armed insurgencies rage across the Middle East, the Sahel, and Southern Asia, and I would now add the episodes between the two Koreas and India, Pakistan, they go on, violent civil conflicts are no longer the primary way that people seek to redress their grievances. Instead, from Tunis to Tahrir Square, from Zuccotti Park to Ferguson, from Burkina Faso to Hong Kong, and now let us add, to 3,000 U.S. towns and cities, movements worldwide have drawn on the lessons of Gandhi, King, and everyday activists at home and abroad, to push for change. And a very hopeful development here is that a lot of self-reliance, a lot of constructive program is emerging. Mass protest has won a world unimaginable only a few weeks ago, writes Rivera Sun in Nonviolence News. Major cities are defunding police units, implementing professional crisis response teams, setting up community-led public safety models, and more. One neighborhood in Seattle, Washington, went even further, ousting their police department and establishing the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, an area in which the police are not allowed. Now, this reminded me of the Ciudades de Paz, the cities of peace that were set up in Colombia. They are like islands of nonviolence. A dramatic one was in Camden, New Jersey, which at one time had such a high murder rate. And think of young Andrew Bott, who was a principal at Orchard Garden School in the Boston area. When he took over that school, it was one of the toughest in the area. The first thing Bott did was fire the security staff, and with the money he saved, he started up the music program, music and art programs. And the effect in reducing violence in the school was dramatic. So this is a critical point that I'm very happy to see developing, because it's important and not always obvious that you need to build alternative security systems before you try to get rid of existing ones. It's interesting that the first time the question of boycotting British goods was raised in India at the Indian National Congress in 1919, Gandhi rejected it as hopelessly unrealistic. He said, just look at yourself. There's not a one of you that is not wearing some item of imported clothing, some garment that's not Indian. For you to boycott non-Indian goods at one stroke, it just won't work. So he did build up Khadi, the cotton spinning campaign, and the networks that it led to, and was able thereby to be in a very strong position to say to the British, okay, now we're going to burn your trousers out here, not the ones you're wearing, and we do not need to import British goods anymore. So I'd like to share another observation, but before I do, I want to add to what I've been saying about self-reliant, constructive programs springing up. There are Shanti Sena-type organizations around the country. These are groups that intervene, trained people intervene in conflict situations, often with very great success in de-escalating the conflict, saving injury. And it's even reached the point where in Lansing, Michigan, the fracas started to develop. A police officer was rushing over to put it down, and his commanding officer tapped him on the shoulder and said, no, 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 it's okay. The peace team will take care of it, which they did. So these organizations are mostly now ramping up their trainings, and that is very good news. And there is a Shanti Sena network, Shanti Sena being, of course, Gandhi's term for peace army that he tried to establish in India just before he was assassinated. The Shanti Sena network, the hub of that is with Meta Peace Teams in Michigan. And they have a small team which is making up a list of resources. And I even imagine the kind of sheet that you just pull out. You know, what kind of conflict are you faced with? If it's an X, then go to resource Y. And more locally, the East Point Peace Academy is also ramping up their trainings, and all of these are being restructured for delivery online, of course, because of the pandemic. If you check out Nonviolence International in Washington, D.C., you'll see a number of offerings for the day, Juneteenth. And now on to my observation. So in 2008, the issue that sparked a lot of protest was inequality. The issue today is police brutality. And of course, it's grown. I think about 50 cities were involved in those protests back in 2008. And now, of course, as we've just heard, it's more like 3,000. So you had inequality for that. You have, for that Occupy movement, you have police brutality for Black Lives Matter and the other groups that are a part of this movement. In between, of course, you had ongoing climate protests. And I'm asking myself, what is the thread? What connects them? Because they are indubitably connected. For example, here's a stunning fact. Globally, 13% of all the environmental activists who were studied in 2,300 campaigns had been murdered to stop their organizing efforts. That's again from Nonviolence News. So despite that kind of connection, there are ongoing connections among the movements. And the question is, how can we connect the dots for much greater effectiveness? And I would even add, after we've connected the dots horizontally to show the kinds of horizontal connections I just pointed out, we need to trace them down to a common origin. We need to look vertically, not just horizontally. And that will lead to much more efficient actions. Often they're what we call stealth operations, where the opponents don't recognize what's happening until it's too late, because it seems unconnected and indirect to them. So we can get a clue where to look in a quote from a new book, Judith Butler's book, The Force of Nonviolence. And here's the quote. In my experience, the most powerful argument against violence has been grounded in the notion that when I do violence to another human being, I also do violence to myself, because my life is bound up with this other life. Which, of course, is also the most powerful argument for nonviolence. We can look upon racism as a failure to see the unity of life, and nonviolence, of course, is an affirmation of that unity. And you will find the same to be true with the issue of inequality, the issue of climate change, I think any other issue facing us. It's a failure to understand, to visualize, to imagine, to see the unity of life. And of course, connected with life's unity is life's sanctity. And we're now seeing this appalling disregard for life among those people who are keen on reopening America. And I remember years and years ago when there was a campaign against DDT in the Berkeley City Council, people arguing that, oh, it's harmless, and even offering to drink some in front of the council meeting. It's an example of how little the sense of life's value and life's interconnectedness can be felt. But of course, that sense can always be reawakened. And I mentioned Rivera Sun in Nonviolence News. She made a very intelligent observation that goes along these lines. It goes back to a phenomenon that Gene Sharp pointed out years ago, that one way to bring down a dictatorship, and this is actually pointed out by Étienne de la Boétie in the 16th century, is not to try to tackle the dictator directly, but to bring down his pillars of support. And it looks like a lot of the things that are being disestablished, built down, defunded, might be looked upon as the pillars of support for an entire system that we want eventually to disassemble. But again, let me strongly recommend that we have a complete system built built in place to rely on instead. So thank you very much. Again, these are very exciting, very hopeful times, and we look forward to more reporting with you at our next episode of the Nonviolence Report.
To end this episode, we'll end with poetry. This is Carla Christopher from Put People First PA, putpeoplefirstpa.org, with a poem she wrote dedicated to Martin Luther King Jr. called The Silence of the Night.
Let me make it clear in the beginning. I preach to you because my conscience leaves me with no other choice. The time has come for America to hear the truth, even if only from a single voice. He who lives with untruth lives a spiritual slave. And you shall know the truth, said Jesus, and the truth shall make you brave. Yes, the truth will set you free, and I've chosen to preach and to poet because I agree that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. There comes a time when silence becomes betrayal. The truth of these words is beyond doubt, but the human spirit can't move without great difficulty against all the apathy in the surrounding world. Yet we must move on. And some of us have already begun to break the silence of the night. As I've walked among the desperate, the rejected, the angry young children, I told them that problems cannot be solved with a weapon. I've tried to offer them my deepest compassion and maintain my conviction in change through nonviolent action. I think of them too, because it's clear to me that no solution can come perfectly until some attempt is really made to know these people meaningfully, to hear their broken cries. Love is somehow the key that unlocks the door to ultimate reality. Let us love one another, for God is love embodied perfectly, and all people are created equally, heirs to a legacy of dignity and worth. Out of one blood, God made all the people to dwell upon the face of the earth. And I know it isn't easy to stand up for truth and for justice. Sometimes it means that you will walk the street with a burdened and a broken heart. But before the crown we can wear, there is a cross that we must bear. So let us bear it. Bear it for justice. Bear it for truth. Bear it for peace. Let us go out this evening with that determination and have not lost faith. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we'll be able to speed up the day when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like that mighty stream. With this faith, every person will be under their vine and their fig tree, and none shall be afraid, because the Lord has spoken and it will be. With this faith, we'll be able to bring forth that moment when all over the world, citizens of freedom will be able to join hands and sing, free at last. Free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last. When child of God will not rise up against child of God, when neighborhood will not rise up against neighborhood, and neither shall they study war no more, then, rather than silence in the night, we can have the sound of all of our voices raised together in one justice-dedicated, peace-filled, and unrelenting fight.
On my way to Washington, feeling mighty sad, thinking about an income that I never had. Everybody's got a right to live. Everybody's got a right to live. And before the building fails, we are.
go down in jail. Everybody's got a right to live.
Black man picked the cotton long time ago. He's been the victim since brought him to the show. Black man dug the ditches, hewed down the pines, gave his trouble to Jesus, kept on towing the line.
Everybody's got a right to live. Everybody's got a right to live. And before this movement fails, we all go down in jail. Everybody's got a right to live.
Black man dug the pipelines both night and day. Black man did the work while a white man got to pay. Now look here, son, this is a brand new day. No more full-time work, no more part-time pay.
Everybody's got a right to live. Everybody's got a right to live. And before this movement fails, we all go down in jail. Everybody's got a right to live.
Yeah, I want my share of silver, I want my share of gold. Want my share of justice, kill my dying soul. Black men dug the ditches long time ago. He's been the victim since brought him to the show.
Everybody's got a right to live. Everybody's got a right to live. And before this movement fails, we all go down to jail. Everybody's got a right to live.